Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com. Hey everyone, today is the 30th anniversary of the passing of Kurt Cobain, lead vocalist, guitarist, and songwriter for the Aberdeen, Washington rock band, Nirvana. Together with my co-host, Chris Fafalius, we break down the writing, recording, and lyrical inspiration, along with our interpretation of the smash hit single, Heart-Shaped Box, taken from Nirvana's 1993 third full-length album, In Utero. Coming off the seemingly overnight success of their breakout record, Nevermind, Nirvana's first new taste of music, Heart-Shaped Box, was probably one of the most unconventional follow-ups to a mega album chock full of hits. This alone is single-handedly one of the most punk rock things Kurt Cobain ever did. Release a song at the height of your popularity that wasn't an obvious cash grab or nod to a past success. So hey, wait, I got a new complaint. Let's dive into this thing right now.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast.
So, Chris, do you remember the first time you heard Heart-Shaped Box?
You know, I don't know if I remember the first time. I was obviously a Nirvana fan. I was probably about 14 years old at this point, 13 or 14. And what I do remember, funny enough, maybe some of our listeners will remember this, but I remember on a Wayne's World sketch on Saturday Night Live. Do you remember this, Chris? When they were watching the music video and he says, "Hey, wait." And they were like, "Is he saying, hey, Wayne?"
Hold on. Is he saying, hey, Wayne? Hey, Chief, if you've got a complaint, give us a call right here at the studio. Don't start, like, blabbing to people on a video.
Do you remember this at all?
I do, now that you say, yeah, and I actually watched the SNL clip that you had put.
Oh, when they played, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and which is a pretty incredible performance.
Yeah.
They sound great.
Yeah, they do. It was always a spectacle when Nirvana was performing live. That's why, you know, in the notes today when I sent them over to you, I'm like, watch these live performances. We even had the live performance of the first time they ever played the song. You could find that on YouTube before they had even recorded it. It was in, I think it was in Sao Paulo, right?
Yes, that was the other one. Yeah, and that was really cool. You know, it wasn't too different. You know, a couple of arrangement things that probably the band did. I don't think Steve Albini did it, you know.
Right.
From all accounts, he's a traditional recording engineer. He gets called a producer, but he lets bands be who they are.
It's really interesting, and I've listened to interviews with Steve Albini in recent years, and I know people that have recorded with Steve Albini, and everything that I hear about him, it doesn't sound like he does a lot. He just kind of lets the band do its thing. And is he just good at mic placement and have the right equipment and have a place with the right vibe? Because it doesn't sound like he's getting into the songs with the bands too much. Like, in our experience with some producers, it's kind of a mystery to me. And what's interesting, Chris, is I never knew this. This was one of the two songs on In Utero. They had someone else mix it. They weren't happy with Steve Albini's mix.
Correct. They had Scott Litt do some remixes. And Scott had worked, I think he got his start or got known for working with REM. And, you know, I had read somewhere, let me see if I can find it, where it says the band, they had a dissatisfaction with the original mix by Albini. The Scott Litt remix features additional vocal harmonies and guitars by Kurt, which were the only elements on the album's 12 tracks not recorded during the original sessions with Albini in February of 93. Now, I don't know so much, by all accounts that I've heard, Chris, I don't know if it was so much the band's dissatisfaction as it was the label's dissatisfaction. Because, man, this song did not sound like a single to me, something that was going to follow up Smells Like Teen Spirit. At the time, I was underwhelmed by this song.
Really?
I have grown to absolutely love it. And now that I put it under the Krista Makes a Podcast microscope here, there is so many cool things in here that I've seen. I kind of think some of them are going to trip you out when I point them out. I think this is the ultimate middle finger to the industry, this song. And I also, how do you feel about this? I kind of feel like Nirvana was so big, they could have released anything and it was going to be huge for that follow-up record. Maybe after In Utero, it would have went sideways had they, you know. But Albini was a purist. You know, he wanted to listen to a band, you know, in their element, listen to them in their rehearsal space, close his eyes, and say, I just want to capture that on tape. That was his whole thing. And this album's pretty raw for a major label release.
It definitely is. And I want to push back on a couple of things you said there. It is pretty wild when you listen to this album, some of the crazy songs on it, Scentless Apprentice, and like just these really raw songs. But I do think that Heart-Shaped Box, the one thing it has is a very classic song structure, you know, verse, chorus, post-chorus, verse, chorus, post-chorus, guitar solo, you know, it's a pretty standard rock structure. And also another thing about it, this might be the best example ever of what we've referred to a lot of times on this podcast as quiet loud, which you'll see Nirvana themselves in interviews refer back to the Pixies as being a big influence on that whole thing for them. So those elements of it, even though this is such a weird and like kind of creepy song, and the video goes right along with the creepiness of it, of course. But those elements of it do lend itself to like a mass appeal. Granted, they could have at this point, after all the success, they could have went for something much more straightforward. They could have went in the way that Dave Grohl went with Foo Fighters or something, right?
Sure. They could have also done what every 80s band did, which was, how do we repeat the success of our big album?
Sure.
Well, you write Teen Spirit Part 2. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if anybody knew Kurt, he was not going to do that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He was going to push back on that as hard as he could.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I watched, in preparation for this episode, man, did I go down a YouTube rabbit hole of watching interviews.
So did I.
I watched so many interviews, like half-hour-long interviews with Kurt Cobain. And the guy was so interesting, so insightful. And I'll say this. The thing that really struck me is I watched Kurt Loder, like the day it happened, because he was the one who came on MTV News and announced it. Well,
yeah.
Later that day, he did like a 5 or 6 minute back and forth talk with, I think the guy's name's David Frick from Rolling Stone.
Yes.
And they talked about Kurt. And I can't tell you how many times Kurt Loder said, people just need to know that Kurt was just such a sweet guy.
We're going to take a look back at Kurt Cobain, his music, the band's music, and the loss of a gentle and wonderful guy.
I thought that was really interesting that he kept making a point to say that. Obviously, Kurt Loder had talked to him a lot of times, and probably, I'd imagine Kurt Loder experienced a lot of assholes in the world of music and really had such nice things to say about Kurt and his experiences with him. Because honestly, you can watch, did you ever watch that Montage of Heck documentary?
I saw snippets of that, not the whole thing. What did you think of that?
I thought it was really good, but I thought that it really painted Kurt in a pretty bad light. Obviously, he was suffering from addiction, but there was some stuff in there that was hard to watch. You know, him really strung out and with the baby in the room and stuff. But it was Frances Bean who actually produced that, or she had something to do with the production of that documentary. But in going down this rabbit hole of watching interviews with him and stuff, I really think that he was a pretty awesome guy with some demons and addiction issues. So I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but just as a songwriter and as someone who would always put his middle finger up to the establishment in so many ways, even in his songwriting, I just think it's fascinating, like especially when we dive into this song.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he was a tortured soul. I think more so, though, I think that he was one of those people that even if he wasn't a musician, he had empathy.
Yes.
And he felt he took upon sadness in a way that, you know, we all process things differently, but I think that he processed things. He talked about seeing small kids with cancer, those commercials on TV,
right,
and said it would just tear him apart for days. He couldn't get past those images, you know, whereas you and I, it's, you know, I'm not thrilled to see that type of stuff, but, you know, I can remove myself from it and go on with my day. It doesn't sound like he could. In Utero, the record in question, it was recorded February 13th through the 21st in 1993, 7 or 8 days.
That's it?
Top to bottom. That's it. It was mixed February 22nd through the 26th of 93. Heart-Shaped Box was released on August 30th of 93. I believe the band played the Reading Festival that year in England, right around the time of its release. I could be wrong with that. But the album was released on September 21st of 1993. And so many cool things, like I said, in this song to go over with you. Things that I never realized until I really broke it apart on here. Again, when the song first came out, I was, how old was I? I was just shy of my 20th birthday, actually. So the album came out about a week before my 20th birthday in 93. I love Nirvana, but this song as a first single was kind of underwhelming, and it's become probably one of my favorite Nirvana songs. And I've also seen, I don't know if you found this, Chris, that a lot of people's favorite Nirvana record is In Utero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's hard because both albums, I mean, I'm not counting Bleach, but between Nevermind and In Utero, they both have, there's a really good argument for either one.
They're both their own animal.
Yeah.
They really are.
Yeah. Nevermind, in certain ways, is much more of like a pop album. Drain You?
Well, and I think that was Butch Vig's thing with Kurt. It was, you know, he's like, okay, you can't sit here in one breath and tell me your favorite band's the Beatles, but you don't want to layer vocals or do harmonies. And, you know, he had Kurt trapped in a corner at that point. He couldn't argue. And I think that maybe some of the pop sensibility you were speaking of came out with that. But you want to get into this thing?
I do.
Well, Heart-Shaped Box, 4 minutes, 41 seconds. The intro is 8 bars of clean guitar and single bass notes. The first guitar you hear is panned all the way to the left. Then the bass guitar comes in, along with another clean guitar panned far right. On bar 6, this guitar panned far right, Chris, is not anywhere, even near the ballpark in terms of timing. And I wrote here in the notes, Albini, feel.
Yeah.
Because I never noticed that before. I mean, it's horribly out of time. It should have been, I guess, by all accounts, fixed, but it was left. I love that. As the first single of your record, this is what you're presenting. I could see the label heads at Geffen going nuts.
Trying to kind of comprehend the guitar in the verses was a little hard for me as a bassist, but I will say the bass is so low and menacing. It's almost like sub bass.
Yes.
Going on in there. And the guitar being so sparing throughout this, I think menacing is the best word to use for these verses. Like, there's just something so eerie and haunting about the music alone, let alone once the vocals come in.
Yeah, and I never would have said this as a younger musician or younger person, but this song's heavy. It's got a heaviness to it that I wouldn't associate with heaviness when I was younger. You know, it had to be some big crazy metal band, you know. But in this case, it's especially the choruses just are heavy. That sub bass you're talking about later in the song, it's like a big muff or something happens on the guitars too, and they get fuzzier and crazier there. But right off this intro, the drums come in with the vocals on the verse. And Chris, what Dave is playing is genius. I feel without Dave, it's not the same band.
No.
And that's not to take anything away from Kurt. What Dave is playing in these verses, it's as you said, the dynamics, it's heavy and it's soft. He's going back and forth. And what that brings here is, I think it adds that eeriness you're talking about. The guitar string bends in the verse, wow, that he's doing. Man, that was mesmerizing to watch him play live and do that as he's singing, because I don't know, my brain, I'd have a really hard time trying to pull that off.
There's so much bending in this song,
yes,
because we'll get to it in the chorus, but then there's bending of the bass in the chorus, and that's just another one of those things that just something sounds off, but it adds to the coolness. It makes it not sound like anything else out there. It's just one of those 50 elements of this song that made it sound so singular, that made it Nirvana, that made it sound like no one else.
Yeah, and the guitars aren't perfectly in tune, again, or played perfectly. It was meant to breathe. It was meant to sound how it sounds, which, again, you know, Albini listens to a band, and he wants to capture what he hears. The SNL performance, Chris, when Kurt starts the guitar, it's in another key. It's all over the place. He fumbles, and then the band comes in, and you know, Grohl or anybody, no one else was looking around going, what's going on? It's just, that's how he started the song that time.
Right. Right. They came from a place and were influenced by bands, I think, a lot of times coming up in that Seattle scene or whatever, where I don't know, to a certain extent, I think I came up in a world where I wanted everything to sound perfect. And when you played live, you tried to sound as perfect, and still today, try to sound as perfect and precise always as you can, you know? And they came from a whole different world of, that's not what's the most important thing. They're not playing to a click. They're not, you know, all the looseness is an important, one of the most important parts of their sound.
Yeah, it adds to the realness, the rawness. That's the emotion that came out. That's the emotion we captured, not the emotion you fabricated and we captured.
Right.
There's a big difference there. I struggle with that as a performer. I think about that all the time. Like, is this vocal believable? You've heard me say that before on here. You know, did the person sell the vocal? Do I believe it? And believing it and feeling it is a huge part. She eyes me like a Pisces when I am weak. I've been locked inside your heart-shaped box for weeks. I've been drawn into your magnet tar pit trap. I wish I could eat your cancer when you turn black.
Something I want to say before we start diving into these lyrics. It's funny, when I watch these interviews with Kurt, he's saying like, yeah, I write these lyrics. It's what comes out of me. And people try to analyze them, and I'm just like, I sometimes just make up what they're about after. He's like, I don't know what they're about. Like, he kind of, more or less, he says things like that. But I got to tell you, I first went through these lyrics and I wrote down what I thought they meant. Then I went online and read, you know, things where people tore them apart and put meanings on them. And I'm like, man, that's pretty, if that's what Kurt was going for, that's pretty deep and seems pretty believable, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, for example, that first line, "She eyes me like a Pisces when I am weak." Well, Kurt's birthday is February 20th, 1967, making him on the Aquarian Piscean cusp. So first and foremost, let's say this is one thing we know for sure, that this song is about Courtney Love to a certain extent, his relationship with Courtney Love. That seems to be pretty widely accepted about this song. But one of the things I read online where I'm like, I kind of believe that is, so he says this line, and Pisces are thought to be imaginative, sensitive, compassionate, kind, selfless, but also secretive, weak-willed, and easily led. So, you know, I saw it and, you know, someone analyzed this and saying like, well, he's saying that Courtney's treating him like a Pisces when he's weak, you know, which is interesting.
Yeah, he also talks about Cancer here. Now, is that Cancer the disease, or is that Cancer the astrological sign?
Well, so Chris,
there's
Cancer,
another play on words there.
Let me tell you, Cancer is Courtney Love's astrological sign.
That was my next question.
but I also read those stories like you did, Chris, about Kurt, when he was talking about this song, he talked about seeing those commercials on TV of kids with cancer was what he said was like the thing that bothered him the most.
Yeah, I guess the 1993 Nirvana biography, Come As You Are, The Story of Nirvana, Kurt told author Michael Azarod that Heart-Shaped Box was written about children with cancer. It's quoted as Kurt saying, "Every time I see documentaries about little kids with cancer, I just freak out. It affects me on the highest emotional level, more than anything else on television." And it goes on after that, but that's kind of what I was talking about a little bit earlier. You know, he was affected by that. And who knows, maybe whatever mood he was in that day, he was bored. And when he gave that interview, and that was the story that day. Musicians love to do that. You know, when you're on your 15th interview of the day, like he was, you know, it's like, how many times can I answer this question? I'm just going to make up a different story every time. And it at the time, before social media, those kinds of rumors were great for bands.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what he did. I think he had fun doing that. Like, I think he was being honest when he said, "I just write whatever." He was, from what I've read, he was more of a melody guy than, not saying that his lyrics aren't amazing, but he kind of just, the lyrics became what came out of him. And I think he had fun telling people they meant different things. Tell each interviewer it means something else. Like the title of the song, Heart-Shaped Box, supposedly it's about a collection of heart-shaped candy boxes that Courtney kept in the front room of their apartment that they lived in together. Mm. And Chris, I don't know if this is an obvious thing. I mean, there's not really that many lines. We can kind of go line by line in this song. The thing about the magnet tar pit trap.
Uh-huh.
Well, black tar heroin was the most common form of heroin found in the Pacific Northwest at that time.
Sure.
So a lot of people think, I mean, that line, I would have deciphered it that way even without reading any of this, but being drawn into the magnet of a tar pit trap, being drawn into drug addiction, to the allure of heroin, right? Like, that's what I would take from that line.
Absolutely. And, you know, Pat Smear didn't join the band until this tour. I think it was just the three of the guys and Albini that made the record. Mm-hmm. I can't tell if it's Grohl or Kurt here. They're singing pretty much on every line of this song besides Kurt. There's another vocal, maybe him doubled. But on every line here in the verse, it's not a true harmony on every line. It's like you can hear him kind of ghosting in and out. It's like a double, but it's not lined up. It's super loose. There's parts of it which are kind of toony at best, but it was left. And to your point, again, I think that's part of this hauntingness. It doesn't sound pretty.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I could not. I was listening in headphones. I was listening so much. I'm like, is it harmonies? I know it becomes a harmony once he gets to the line, "I've been drawn into your magnet tar pit trap."
Yeah.
But is it just doubled before that? I can't tell. I kept trying to listen so hard and I couldn't hear it. It was sung so low.
That was the other thing. It's where it sits in the mix that I think is eerie too. And if I were to try to go word by word, I wouldn't be able to discern exactly where the harmonies are. No, but it's definitely a combination of both. Coming out of verse one, you know, we get this two-bar heavy tom buildup with these big, nasty stereo guitars and the bass to launch into chorus one, and it's interesting. Chorus one is the same lyric as chorus two and chorus three. Mm-hmm. The chorus never gets longer. Hey, wait! Hey, wait, I got a new complaint. Forever in debt to your priceless advice. Hey, wait, I got a new complaint. Forever in debt to your priceless advice. Hey, wait, I got a new complaint. Forever in debt to your priceless advice. Your advice. Harmonies on everything here again. Definitely on the hey and the wait. I got a new complaint. And then it just sounds like a double on forever in debt to your priceless advice. And again, harmonies and melodies weaving in and out here. But whew, what a powerful, powerful chorus.
Yeah, I was thinking about being in a giant mosh pit when this song kicks in, you know? Imagine it being the early to mid-90s and experiencing this live. I can imagine the electricity in the audience when it kicks mm-hmm. in, you know? It's intense. And
would you have been in a double X shirt and a pair of 40 pants?
Oh, I would be. I'd probably have very big Dickie shorts on, but yes, a very big shirt and very sweaty. But yeah, I mean, it's so awesome. And I got to tell you, that line, that, hey, wait, I've got a new complaint. Speaking of everything we talked about in the first verse, I got to tell you this Kurt quote. He said, in referring to that line, that's just me giving an example of how I'm perceived. People don't realize that I'll say something and it'll be quoted in an article. Then it'll be taken out and used in another article in a different place. And then again, and then again. I'll only have said it once, but it looks like I'm complaining all the time. So that could lend itself right to what we were saying, where it's like, I don't want to say the same thing. People are going to keep using this quote over and over again. I'm just going to say something different every time. Like, having fun and being tired of dealing with people's criticisms of him and what he says.
Yeah. You had sent me over a link to a show in Seattle around this time performing this song as well as the SNL performance. I got to tell you, I never really thought of Pat Smear as a singer, but his backing vocals on the chorus in particular, you can really hear him and it's killer. He's snarly, he's snotty. It's like, okay, yeah, that is the guitar player from the Germs. I get it. You know, I never really picked up on that.
It's funny, some of the stuff that I read, it seemed like towards the end of Kurt's life, first of all, he referred to Pat Smear as a hero of his. And towards the end there, like when they were touring and stuff, it was kind of like Dave Grohl and Chris Novoselic were in one bus and Pat Smear and Kurt were in the other. And it seemed like Kurt and Pat spent a lot of time together towards the end of Kurt's life. Like that was, I don't know if it was just tension among these guys that he'd been playing with for years and this was like a new guy to hang out with or what. But I also thought it was interesting, Chris, you know, towards the end of Nirvana, it was sounding like from reports that they were on the verge of breaking up. And it seemed like Kurt, this is really interesting to me because I think of them musically as being so different. He loved Michael Stipe, was playing music with Michael Stipe. Supposedly they had a project together in the works. And that seemed to be Kurt's best friend towards the end of his life was Michael Stipe. I just thought that's so interesting because I don't think of their music as being anywhere near, but they do both seem like sensitive guys.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard that before, nor did I hear the bus story where they separated. That's interesting.
Hey, everybody, we got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Do you love to watch movies? Because I do. And if you're anything like me, you like to watch them in the theater. So Regal Unlimited just makes sense. Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass that pays for itself in just two visits. See any standard 2D movie, anytime, with no blackout dates or restrictions. When you want to watch a movie in a premium format like 4DX, IMAX, RPX, or ScreenX, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost. And with Regal Unlimited, you won't just save money on tickets. You'll also save on snacks. Members get 10% off all non-alcoholic concession items. So, if you're planning to see two movies this month, you'll need to join Regal Unlimited. Sign up now in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. Use code DEMAKES24 to let them know we sent you.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
And now, back to the show.
Out of chorus one, after Kurt says forever in debt to your priceless advice, he says your advice again over an 8-bar heavy post chorus. It's a great setup to bring things back down in verse two. And I wrote here, Chris, of course, Pixies, Breeders, that soft, loud thing. And I think that's something when talking about Nirvana that isn't talked about enough. It's those dynamics. And again, I attribute a lot of that to Grohl. Not trying to make this about Dave. This was definitely Kurt's baby, his band, definitely this song. But man, the dynamics are killer. Verse two. Eating orchids, forgive no one just yet. Cut myself on angel hair and baby's breath. Broken hymen of your highness, I'm left black. Throw down your umbilical noose so I can climb right back.
Wow.
Man.
Wow. Hey, one thing I want to point out, Chris, I don't know if you noticed, it's one of those like magical recording moments. There is a little crack in Kurt's voice on the words angel hair.
Yes.
You probably couldn't say go in the booth and do that. It just happened that way and they kept it. Maybe you or I would have went, no, I got to fix that. But no, that's the way it is. That's the way Kurt performed it. And it just adds to the charm and the mystique of the song.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of this stuff was one take with him.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely the verses, you know, maybe not the choruses. Choruses had to be doubled and whatnot. But yeah, just in meat eating orchids. That's how he starts off verse two.
Well, what I read about that. Now, whether this is right or not, I don't know. But I guess orchids are known for their vaginal appearance. And meat, in this case, could be a phallic image. Thus, what he's saying is, women have trouble forgiving men. That's what I saw. Like, an interpretation of that line online. I don't know whether I believe that or not. Another thing I saw was the angel hair and baby's breath are both known to be very soft and delicate and therefore invoke images of softness and comfort, but not for Kurt. He's hurt by these gentle things. And if you want to go even further with that thing, Chris, angel hair is a parasitic plant that literally cuts open the host plant and grows roots inside of it. And baby's breath is commonly used in wedding bouquets, which could allude to his marriage. And it could be that he is making the comparison in that his marriage to Courtney Love became a parasite and he's the host. I saw people make that interpretation of that.
Well, and of course, we've seen this done with Beatles lyrics and whatnot. And I'm not trying to take anything away from the genius of Kurt Cobain, but could it be, Chris, that he just scribbled down these lyrics and people are you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
did he, sure. Was he, did he have that much forethought? Here was a guy in the throes of heroin addiction. You know, was he thinking all these points? Well, the angel hair is this and the baby breath, it relates to this and baby breath is for weddings. And I mean, I can't imagine, not even Kurt, I can't imagine anybody having that. Although you talk to some writers, like I'll reference Brett Gurewitz when he was talking about the lamppost crying and all these things, and I'm going, oh my gosh, this guy's for real.
Well, Kurt might, if he was here today, have a laugh about you and I trying to decipher these lyrics. He might be like, that's just some stuff I wrote down. It's just gibberish. But I gotta tell you, someone who would have some insight into what's what, Courtney in 2012 wrote on Twitter that Heart-Shaped Box was about her vagina because she was tweeting at Lana Del Rey, who had covered the song in Sydney. She wrote, "You do know that song is about my vagina, right? Throw down your umbilical noose so I can climb right back. On top of which, some of the lyrics about my vagina I contributed." But then she deleted the tweet after, so I don't know if she actually did contribute any lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to say something slightly in Courtney's defense real quick. People really like to say some terrible stuff about Courtney Love, obviously. In fact, some people, there's conspiracy theories about her having something to do with his death and stuff, which I think is pretty outlandish and really mean. Like when your husband dies and then people are going to say that stuff about you. But from what I read and what I watched Kurt say, he really loved Courtney Love. Like, he really thought highly of her as a partner and as a musician and things. So I don't know. When Courtney says something that she contributed or she had something to do with it, I don't completely write it off.
Well, and again, you know, this is great for the press. Mm-hmm. Her daughter and her, they control the estate of Kurt. So, you know, I mean, a good story is a good story. It's plausible. It's certainly plausible this could have been about what she's saying.
Right.
Verse 2 has the same basic instrumentation as verse 1. And again, Chris, we get those half melodies, half harmony, that low backing vocal that's just kind of there and adding to that hauntingness. And then we get right into chorus 2. Same basic instrumentation as chorus 1, same lyrics as chorus 1. Hey, wait. Your advice at the end comes on the post-chorus, I'm calling it, 8-bar heavy post-chorus. Guitars sound massive here. This is when it seems like they put another big muff or fuzz tone on the guitars or some kind of sub even more on the bass there. Do you hear that?
I can't pinpoint it. My ears aren't skilled enough to pinpoint why there is a sort of growing intensity as the song goes on. Obviously, once we get to the guitar solo, I know the intensity of that.
Right.
But yeah, I subconsciously I hear these things.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we can attribute that to Scott Litt. I think that, you know, this would have been, and it talked about it earlier, would have been a very different song with Albini mixing this. I think he would have got the levels of the song, and that kind of would have been it. I don't think there would have been much like, oh, here's the chorus, we got to, you know, bring the levels up, or here's the bridge, we got to hit that sub bass a little louder here and make the song grow till the end. I'm definitely hearing that. I absolutely love it. After chorus two, we get into eight bars of super overdriven bass and the most 90s sounding guitar solo ever.
Yeah. It's a nasty guitar solo.
It is.
I guess it was way nastier before what we're hearing. I don't know if you read what Chris Novoselic said. Did you see that?
I certainly did. Chris said that he was unhappy with the original effect used during the song's guitar solo, and he recalled arguing with Kurt and Steve Albini about it. He said, "Why do you want to take such a beautiful song and throw the hideous abortion in the middle of it?"
Yeah. I mean, and it's still the version we know, it's still nasty sounding, like that tone and whatever on it. So I can't even imagine what it sounded like before that.
Yeah, it's like doubled or tripled this solo. It's got flange on it. It's pretty crazy. And this guitar solo is over the chorus progression. Then there's eight bars of those big stereo guitars ringing out, and the bass gets very playful with the drums. On bar five, Chris, here, before we get into verse three, it's almost like a bad edit on the guitars. It sounds like an overdub, but a really cool one. And this whole reset is a lot like, and this is one of the things I wanted to point out. I said that it's very crazy that I came across this. It took me 30 years to 31 years to realize this, but it's a lot like Teen Spirit before the final verse of that song. So remember, here it's the chorus progression that the solo's playing over. In Teen Spirit, it's the verse. The guitar's going, now, 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 now. And then the guitars ring out before you go into the last verse of Teen Spirit.
Oh.
It's the same thing happening here. The guitars ring down and it gets to this third verse of Heart-Shaped Box. And looking back now, I never saw a similarity at all between this song and their last hit. And it's kind of like, they borrowed a trick that I never realized.
It's a Nirvana trick.
It is.
I like that trick. Let that ring out over what becomes a quiet part again. That's interesting. That's good. Good catch.
Yeah, that's dynamics. And I've thought that before, and I've sang it in my head, and I didn't realize until I broke it down here. I've sang both songs in my head, confusing them.
Oh.
I've gotten to the part, yeah, and I'll be singing Heart-Shaped Box, but then I'll go into the last verse of Teen Spirit. And I never realized that confusion till now. Now I know why I do it. This part, re-listen to it again, and then go listen to Teen Spirit, and that same part, you'll be like, wow, the comparison's pretty cool, and I'm sure you'll throw a clip into as you usually do, Chris.
When you turn back.
verse 3. Interesting here, okay? We got the choruses in this song, and as we know, Kurt was a prolific writer, lyricist. He certainly wasn't short on information, but the choruses are all the same in this song. And now we get hit with the third verse, but it's verse one again, yeah. The same lyrics.
Yeah.
Why do you think he wanted to drive that home?
I don't know. I would think that it was the speed at which... I mean, you blew my mind when you said they recorded the whole album in whatever that was. What is it? Less than
7 days. Yeah.
You're a major label. You're one of the biggest bands in the world at this point, and you're recording a whole album in a week and a half or something?
Chris, they did the record for $25,000.
That is just mind-boggling.
Yeah. They could have worked with anybody. They could have worked with Rick Rubin. They could have worked with Bob Rock. They could have had anybody in the world, and they went with, you know, an indie engineer, Steve Albini, to do the record. It doesn't get much more punk rock than that.
And I think that you summed it up. It was punk rock. It was the guttural instinct of what we should do. We go back to the first verse. It probably benefits a band in a certain way. It's like people learn the lyrics quicker and can sing along quicker. It's very interesting and it's very rudimentary. It's what you would do when you're writing your first songs ever, you know? And yeah. I think it's pretty interesting. Chris, hey, one thing I forgot to mention while we're in a verse here, as a bassist that I noticed that I never really thought about before, is what Chris Novoselic is playing on the bass in the verses is he's playing like staccato, like bump, 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 bump.
She has me like a Pisces where I am weak.
What made him want to play that way instead of just like letting notes ring out or playing a more steady rhythm? It's almost like staccato the way he's playing that, or like all downstrokes.
Yeah, and I'm assuming Chris played that, you know, and I say that because, yeah, he's credited. You never know in the studio. Did Kurt play the bass? Did Albini hand the bass to Grohl and say, hey, I like your feel on this? I don't know. I'd like to think Chris played it. And if he did, and those are his contributions, then I'm glad you brought that up because he doesn't really get mentioned. It's always Dave because Dave went on to Foo Fighters, and Kurt is a legend for a number of reasons, legend alive and a legend in death. But that bass part is killer. If he came up with that and that's his feel, then that's rad.
It's interesting. Cool. It was just an interesting choice, you know? And hey, I don't know. One more thing I wanted to mention. I don't want to get through this episode without mentioning this because I thought it was really funny and weird. Obviously, Nirvana did not record to a click. They didn't believe in recording to a click. But on this song, because they couldn't get the tempo right, they tried to set up a strobe light for Dave Grohl to play along with. And he said, we had this long conversation about it and about how it won't dictate the tempo, just imply the tempo. And he said, I sat there for a take or two with this fucking strobe light in my face until I practically had a seizure. So they tried to have their version of a click track for this song.
Poor Dave. Felt like he was at a rave while recording it. Poor guy. Well, verse 3, Chris, the last lyric, I wish I could eat your cancer, on When You Turn Black. On You Turn Black, there's a low growly vocal that comes in there. It's super present just on You Turn Black. It's creepy.
When you turn black.
It's like the monster from the basement or something. It just adds another really, really cool element. Before we get into chorus 3.
Forever in debt to your prices and vows. Hey, wait, I got a new complaint. Forever in debt to your prices and vows.
Again, same overall basic instrumentation and lyrics as chorus one and chorus two. And then at the end here on the last line, forever in debt to your priceless advice. There's like this, another bass sub drop or something that comes in at the end. It's like, vroom, and it happens on the next couple lines. Your advice, your advice, your advice. And that's 16 bar post-chorus this time. The song ends on bar 15, and the guitars are the final thing you hear fading out into like this pedal amp noise radio interference thing that's happening. And again, just kind of falls apart,
yep.
Which this whole song has a feeling at any moment the wheels could come off.
Yeah, it falls apart. Feels like a cliffhanger or something. Like it really, really, the word menacing keeps coming to my mind about this song. There's a sort of just an overall menacing feel to this song.
I think the one thing for me, and Kurt in particular, I would have loved to have seen what he did later. You know, I would have loved to have seen if he bowed to trends and got his hair cut and looked like a Backstreet Boy for a minute. And I doubt that was what was going to happen with him.
Never.
You know, was he, you know, was he going to continue going against the grain, doing what he did? Would Nirvana have went on? We'll never know. But I do know that, you know, the longer that he's been gone, the more appreciation that I have for him as a songwriter.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of was dismissive when he passed. It was, yeah, drugs did that and blah, blah, blah. I don't want to say I was heartless, but I was young, and I think about it a lot different now. I think about what he went through, and I'm thankful for him as a songwriter. I love this song. I didn't think it was a great follow-up single back in the day. I was expecting Paint by Numbers, Teen Spirit Part 2, and I'm glad that that Kurt didn't deliver that to us.
Yeah, I was thinking about today, when people are hearing this, it's the 30-year anniversary of the day they discovered Kurt Cobain's body and that the world learned that he had died. And 30 years, we are now 3 years past the entire length of his life since he died. You know, there's been 27 plus three since he's been gone. And his music lives on this long. I said it to you before, Chris, I think in an After Party episode, that I was 13 years old when he died. I liked Nirvana, but at that age, I don't think I really understood the difference between life and death, or that like this was a real person,
yeah,
or something. Like it was almost like I was watching a TV show. This was entertainment. I understood that the guy was dead, but maybe at that age, you don't understand what that is, what that means. And it doesn't hit as hard. And like it hits harder than ever when I think about artists like Kurt that are gone too soon. And
it's that when that finality sits in, that's really what it is.
Yeah.
But thanks for combing through this one with me, Chris, on the 30th anniversary of the passing of Mr. Kurt Cobain. Rest in peace.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.